What happened to music that meant something?
The Who at the Kingdom or Kiss at the Coliseum. Where is the Misty Mountain Hop? Where is the Smoke on the Water? Where is the Iron Man of today?
Hey, this is not a test. This is rock and roll.
Kurt Cobain famously called Teenage Fan Club the best band in the world. 2 decades later, they released their 10th album and are back on the road. I'm Greg Cott of the Chicago Tribune.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis of Vocalo.org. Today, Teenage Fan Club performs live in our studio. And later on, Greg and I review the new album by rapper-producer Kanye West. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions.
From WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX, you're listening to Sound Opinions, and time now for some music news.
The long and winding road that leads to your door will never disappear. I've seen that road before. It always leads me here. Lead me to your door.
Yes, indeed, it has been a long and winding road. Our long international vigil, Jim, is finally over. The Beatles are at last on iTunes. That seems to be the most asked question when it comes to the iTunes store over the last 5 or 6 years. When are the Beatles finally going to be on there? You notice that really doesn't get asked of a lot of other bands, but the Beatles finally have agreed with Steve Jobs to make their music available on iTunes. I think the big question for Beatles fans, was the music going to be available separately as individual tracks in addition to albums? And yes, the good news is that individual tracks are going to be made available in addition to the album. So you've got the album selling for about $12.99, the individual track selling for $1.29, premium prices by iTunes standards, immediately undercut by Amazon, which does not have the MP3s available, but they did cut the prices on their CDs in response to this big news. It's interesting because this is now the sixth major incarnation, by my count, of the Beatles catalog that people are being asked to buy yet again.
Now, how are you counting that down?
I'm counting vinyl, I'm counting 8-track, I'm counting cassette, I'm counting the original CD issue in the 80s, and then the remastered CDs yet again last year. You can also throw in the Beatles Rock Band format if you want that. Remember, they dipped their toes in the digital stream last year with Beatles Rock Band. Now they follow it up with iTunes.
You know, well, to say nothing of box sets and those past Masters CDs and any number of other best of one-offs.
I don't know about you, but I'm finding the response to this sort of being rather anticlimactic. A lot of yawns out there from people who are saying, now you're doing this? It would have been big news 5 years ago.
I'll tell you what my response is. Outrage. The Beatles, for half a century, have had one of the most loyal fan bases in the history of popular culture. How nice would it have been for a period of weeks or months or the first year to say, you have bought these albums 3, 4, 5, 6 times. We're going to give them away for X amount of time as a free download so that now you can put them in your mobile devices. They have more money, the estates of Harrison and Lennon, McCartney and Ringo, than the highest living king could ever spend in 100 lifetimes. Come on.
But see, there's more at stake here than just the Beatles' estates. Obviously, they've never turned their backs on any revenue stream, but there's also EMI involved, their record company, which is in huge financial trouble. I think this is a last-ditch effort on EMI's part to get yet another chunk of money out of the Beatles' back catalog because they are in desperate financial straits. So it's not just the Beatles involved in this decision, but it's their record company as well.
Well, let me tell you, EMI, money can't buy you love, and love is all you need. You know, Greg, this begs the question, are there any really significant artists still left as holdouts not selling their music on the iTunes store? I think this list speaks for itself. AC/DC, Garth Brooks, Kid Rock, and Bob Seger. He could sell his music to Chevy, but he's not selling his music through iTunes. I You're listening to Sound Opinions, and that is the song About You by the Scottish power pop group Teenage Fan Club. Greg, these guys have been one of the longest running and most consistently rewarding acts of the last 2.5 decades. Formed in their native Scotland in 1989, they are now on album number 10 called Shadows, and they were on a worldwide tour when they came by to our studio. The key, I think, of appreciating Teenage Fan Club is that there have always been not one, not two, but three great songwriters, and the way their voices and their guitars merge is nothing short of magical. Norman Blake, Raymond McGinley, Gerard Love, those are the three songsmiths, been together from the beginning. Francis McDonald, now been on drums merely a couple of decades, not the whole history, and they're touring with their pal Dave McGowan on keys. A truly extraordinary band, and it was great to have them in here.
That longevity is truly remarkable, Jim, no doubt about it. So when they were in the studio with us, we took them back to the very beginning, and I asked guitarist Norman Blake to tell us about the band's formation.
Okay, well, myself and Raymond and Francis had an earlier group called the Boy Hairdressers, and we made one single, 12-inch single, on a label based in Edinburgh called 53rd and 3rd. One of the people who ran that label was a guy called Stephen Pastel, or people pronounce it Pastel over here, you know. he was a friend of ours, so we had made that record and the group kind of petered out. But we had some of the songs that we had left over from that group, we used or started to think about in terms of having a new band, putting a new band together and recording them. Yeah, we wrote a bunch of songs, demoed those up, and got a little bit of money. And went into a small studio. It was a very small amount of money it was, I hasten to add. And we went into a studio in Glasgow and recorded the songs. From there, we gave a cassette to Stephen Pastel, who passed that cassette on to Gerard Cosloy, who was starting Matador at the time.
Yeah.
And before we knew it, we were signed to an American record label.
Yeah.
And so it all kind of happened very quickly.
Not just any American record label. Matador was a big taste-making label.
That's right, it was, yeah. And I think her album is maybe the third album that was released on the label. So it was way, way back at the start of Matador, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, just recently they've had their big 21st anniversary show in Vegas.
That's right.
Raymond, what struck me when I first had my mind blown by A Catholic Education, remains one of my favorite records, was you guys were so out of step with everything else that was going on. We had the nascent grunge thing beginning to happen from Seattle, you know. We were starting to hear Nirvana and Mudhoney, right? At home in the British Isles, you know, you had the Manchester dance grooves, and you had the shoegazers. And yet you guys were doing something different. This was power pop, perhaps a genre you've come to hate, because nobody ever knows what that word means, right?
No.
But what were you listening to in Glasgow, and what was inspiring you guys, first in the Boy Hairdressers and then in Teenage Fan Club?
I mean, I think in terms of being, you know, outside of stuff, I think at that point in time in Glasgow, there wasn't really a lot happening. So I think we did just feel outside of a lot of stuff because when Glasgow were separate from whatever else was going on in the rest of the country. But I mean, we were into records like, at the time, you know, like XL, Rolling Stones, XL and Main Street or things. And I think we liked a lot of American stuff like Sonic Youth and Dinosaur Jr. and stuff like that, and together with loads of other stuff. But I think as a band, I think we wanted to be a kind of straightforward. We grew up, I suppose, in Britain with the NME and those kind of music papers that it seems like you'd get bands that would form and do interviews and kind of develop a kind of persona or something, maybe even before they'd really done anything, and be defined by that. And we kind of wanted to just go away, write some songs, record them, finish the album, do the whole thing before we interacted with any of that stuff. A deliberately made the album first before we did anything.
Yeah.
No one knew who we were. There was nothing outside of just us doing our thing. We hadn't interacted with anyone in any way at all.
Well, talking maybe a little bit about that NME thing where it was about the image and maybe a little bit of the fashion and the trends of the day were kind of dominating how you should sound.
It would change from week to week with the NME. Every week they would, because it was a weekly publication, every week they would have to be championing something, you know, and so that's why all these bands formed who hadn't really done anything, you know, they would have one song and they would have the front cover of the NME. It was that easy.
Yeah.
If you kind of said the right things and if you were at that time probably based in London. And so for us, yeah, we liked the idea of making the album and then presenting it as a fait accompli.
Sound of that first album, Gerard, maybe you can talk about this a little bit. I mean, Catholic Education, a little bit more aggressive in some ways than maybe later work. Was there any particular reason for that sort of sound at that point?
I guess Norman and Raymond had written the songs before we went to record it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think maybe when you're kind of younger, I think maybe you like to kind of dress things up and hide behind distortion a little, you know. Maybe you just want to kind of bury... I remember Norman always wanted to bury his vocals in the mix.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose we were just inexperienced. We didn't really know what we were doing.
And as you said, studio, it was a little studio and a little money.
Exactly, and a little amount of time. You know, we didn't have... we only had a few days to record the record.
One more ancient history question. I think the Fannies, as your longtime followers... we have this notion, because you guys have stayed together so long and you've always shared songwriting duties and you sing so beautifully together, we just have this notion that you guys like have been friends since you were three or something. Is that true? Before Boy Hairdressers, when did you actually meet?
No, really, just we kind of met around the Glasgow music scene. There was a club called Splash One, which was a great club, actually. It was run by Bobby Gillespie from Primal Scream and a few of his friends. And they had Splash One psychedelic punk rock happenings once a month for a couple of years. And they put on great bands. They had Felt and the Jesus and Mary Chain. Sonic Youth played there. Wire.
Yeah,
and they played great records, lots of garage records, 13th floor elevators, that kind of thing.
Yeah, the club was named after an elevator song.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There you go, Splash One, of course, yeah. We hung out there quite a bit and all sort of met through that.
Can we keep that thing in our head of the Beatles where you like all live in one house that's all attached?
Yeah,
can we just,
yeah.
Don't disillusion us too much.
Yeah. We do that now.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Your wives must be kind of thinking, what's going on here, guys?
Like the Monkees or the Beatles. Well, why don't you give us a song? We have Teenage Fan Club here and they've got instruments in their hands. Poor Francis is going ultra minimal. Not on drums. He's got a tambourine and he's got his foot mic'd.
Yeah. I've been relegated, but yeah. I'll do my best.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll play a song from our new album called Baby Lee. Shake me.
watching from a distance. Marry, marry me, oh baby, now I am insistent. Baby Lee, I'm only trying to remind you. They had me in mind, oh yeah, when they designed you. Baby Lee, I'm always watching from a distance. Marry, marry me, oh baby, now I am insistent.
That's Baby Lee by Teenage Fan Club live on Sound Opinions. We're going to have more with the Scottish pop band after a short break on Sound Opinions from WBEZ and PRX. And then Jim and I are going to review the latest from hip-hop icon Kanye West. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and that's Star Sign by our guest this week, Teenage Fan Club. That's the band's biggest U.S. hit to date from the album that brought them their first big success in the States, Bandwagon-esque. They had released two well-received albums prior to that in their native Scotland. Then Bandwagon-esque came out on Creation Records and famously became Spin Magazine's best album of 1991. Get this, it beat out Nirvana's Nevermind and R.E.M.'s Out of Time for that honor. So that's where we pick up our conversation, with that turning point year of 1991.
'91's a pretty good year for rock. Out comes this album, not long after this album by this band Nirvana, which has a baby going after a dollar on a fish hook.
Yeah.
They're rather cheeky, these Brits. Give us an album with a cartoon of a big money bag on it.
Yeah.
They have left the indie Matador Records and signed to Geffen and given us this album, Bandwagon-esque. The title, the cover, everything seems to be saying, yeah, we're ready to sell out. I mean, in retrospect, this has got to take your breath away. Spin Magazine says it's the album of the year. The heck with Nirvana's Nevermind.
Yeah.
The heck with My Bloody Valentine's Loveless.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's pretty, well, gee, two of the best albums of the last century.
The reviews editor at Spin Magazine was a guy called Stephen Daly. at the time, who was the drummer in a band called Orange Juice.
Oh, yeah.
Who were from Glasgow. So there were possibly there was a bit of nepotism going on there. So, yeah.
No, but an extraordinary album. It's one of those albums that is so amazing, and people still love it to this day. Is it like a millstone around your neck? You're 9 albums into this career. That's the one everybody asks you about.
Yeah, we made it, you know, so there's nothing we can do to get away from, you know, talking about it or answering questions about it. It's all good as far as we're concerned. Obviously, we don't listen to our old records and review them. The only time we hear the songs is when we play them live.
Yeah.
You know, because for us, we've always thought it's kind of masochistic to listen to your own music.
And, Jerry, you'd mentioned on the first record, A Catholic Education, that you guys were young, you really didn't know what this is going to all sound like, the vocals were a little buried. It seemed like with that third album, with Bandwagon-esque, the sound really came together, a defining sound. And what was more interesting to me then was the fact that you had 3 amazing songwriters in this band. Everybody was contributing. Usually there's an alpha male and then there's the rest of the band. How did you guys sort of resolve that issue in terms of division of labor within the band?
Yeah, I don't think we ever planned it. About 6 months before we started recording Bandwagon-esque, we rented a room in a town and built a studio. So we'd spend a lot of time there just recording ideas that we all had. And I think we just realised that we had a lot of different ideas, you know.
To us, it seemed like it would be easier to have 4 people writing songs than one. You know, it's like you say, the division of labour. There are 3 of us writing in the band. There's less of a burden on each of us individually. You know, certainly talking about now, we are, I think, 9 or 10 albums into our thing. For one person to be writing songs for each of those albums, you'd be talking about 140 or 150 songs. I would challenge anyone to write 150 good songs. It's not easy.
Yeah, you know? Sure.
So for us, it helps if we share the burden, and hopefully means that we can make better albums.
But it's so interesting. I mean, Shadows, if you look at the song credits, they go, love Blake McGinley, love Blake McGinley, love Blake McGinley. It's kind of this neat division of labor. And I know that you contribute to each other's tunes as well, but it's amazing that it sounds so much of a piece. This album is a journey as much as any of the records you've given us. And yet there is that kind of everybody's...
Yeah. Sure, well, I mean, like you say, we do all play in each other's songs. So in some ways, we could probably rearrange it in another way and it would work okay, but... I think with this and the last album, we've done exactly the same thing. You know, it's just something that we've kind of followed, the way that we've fallen into working.
Well, the other thing, too, is those beautiful harmonies. And I remember, Norman, I talked to you back in the day, 20 years ago, and certain critics would rip on you guys. Oh, they just sound like Big Star. And 99.9% of the people in America, I guarantee you, had no idea who Big Star was back then.
That's true, I'm sure. And we were lucky enough to meet Alex Chilton around about that time. I think all we ever did was wear our influences on our sleeve. We were happy to talk about them. And lots of people are very guarded about what influences them. And, you know, very often if they tell you what influences them, then you can hear it in their music. And so we like the sound of the Big Star records. And actually Alex's solo records, and... we liked his approach to making music. So I suppose it always gets mentioned, the Big Star connection. What you do to me,
I think the larger point was you were bringing melody back in a big way and harmony vocals in a big way.
Sure.
Nobody else was really doing that at the time.
Yeah, we were encouraged by Don Fleming, who produced Bandwagon-esque, to do that. He said to us, you know, you guys are good at doing harmonies and not many other people are doing that. You should maybe focus on that a little, you know, and see what you can do with that. He gave us the confidence to do that, you know.
Mm-hmm. The sense of humor is sometimes lost with you guys. I mean, people don't appreciate, I think, how humorous you can be. You guys covered Like a Virgin, Madonna song. You had all these great songwriters in the band, and yet you covered that song. What was the motivation behind covering Madonna, who was kind of like almost like the, you know, exhibit A of who you don't want to be, you know, at the time, because all the indie bands were too cool for that.
Yeah, I think it was tongue-in-cheek, really.
Yeah.
It was a good song, I think.
It worked. I like that. I still play that version once in a while. I was weak, incomplete. I've been had. I was set in the mood, but you made me feel.
are listening to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. He's Greg Kot. How about another song, fellas?
Yeah.
What are we going to play? Do you want to go old on you?
Don't Look Back, maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's okay, we'll play a song called Don't Look Back.
If I could find the words to say, the sun shines in your eyes, so brighten up my city sky. Break out the news, it's back again, the voice I tried to don't hang on, my hope's never gonna teach me. Wake up, the story's over, climb aboard, I'm going nowhere, and understand if I must say I'd give both his wings away. Driving home, but don't look back on empty feeling. Repaying the blues, my saving grace is lost without a trace. The morning sun's a fire in space. Time to stay. I've got my mind set on something else, so it's hard to see. And I don't need a guiding light to lead me in the dark. And understand if I must say. Drive you home, but don't look back on empty feeling. On empty feeling. On empty feeling. On empty feeling.
Beautiful stuff. That is Don't Look Back from Teenage Fan Club on Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and we're here with Teenage Fan Club, Norman Blake, Raymond McGinley, Jerry Love, Dave McGowan, Francis McDonald. You guys don't come through often enough, as far as I'm concerned. The time keeps stretching between albums.
Last two have been 5 years.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, each.
Any particular reason that it's stretching out between records a little bit more? Do you feel like the standards maybe have gone up in terms of what you'll consider a quality song before you record it?
No. I think we toured quite a bit after both of those records, you know. And I think after that we thought we'd take a bit of time off. And actually, here's the thing with this album. We actually finished it quite a long time ago. But we were looking for a new manager at that time, so we had to basically spend a bit of time finding them.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I assume that money bag on the cover of Bandwagon-esque probably ran out a long time ago. But are you guys still fortunate enough to? Is this your living? Are you able 20 years in to just be a Teenage Fan Club?
No, we still make a living from it. I mean, we're not living in mansions or we're kind of bungalow band.
Uh-huh. That's good.
I like that.
Yeah.
Bungalow band.
Although at this point I would say with a band of your stature, with the three songwriters primarily, each of those guys would have made four or five solo albums by now, much less have a band anymore, because you all feel like, hey, I need more space. I need my 12 songs per album. There's just not enough room for my quality material anymore. And yet you guys have managed to maintain a partnership all these years. How is that?
Well, do you know, we've done other things too. I suppose we, together collectively, we made an album with Jad Fair. When we made that record, we pretty much improvised the music and we switched instruments, and Jad would come up with a lyric that he thought would fit. So that we did that.
I'm glad you brought that up. So it's 2002. Jad Fair, of course, one of the great American underground outsider artists of all time, leader of Half Japanese.
Yeah.
He's part Jonathan Richman and he's part Martian. Not anybody I would have ever thought that Teenage Fan Club would collaborate. Where did that come from? Was it Don Fleming, your old producer?
It was actually through the Pastels. Chad came to Glasgow to spend time with them, and we, myself and Jerry, played with them.
At our studio.
The one we were talking about earlier, where we did the Bandwagon-esque demos, and Chad came over and we met him then. And so he found himself in Glasgow and on numerous occasions around the time we made that record. And he started to stay at my apartment with me and my wife and daughter. On one of those trips, we just got talking one day about the idea of making a record together. And we have a friend who has a little studio, and we booked a couple of days and went in and set up the equipment and, like I say, improvised the album. Mm. And we were pretty pleased with the way it came out. We let Stephen Pastel hear it. And he had a label called Geographic, which goes through Domino Records, and they were keen to release it. And so that came out, and we did a tour.
Yeah.
All from kind of nothing, just a kind of conversation. So that was great.
I want to be near to you. Tenderness in your journal kiss. Gentleness in your tenderness. I have desire, I want, and I need. To be near to you.
It sounds to me like a different method of working for you guys as well, to be thrown into that sort of, make it up.
That's
because
right,
the songs, I get the sense that these songs are thought out and very well structured. There's a sense of, we know exactly how this is going to sound when we go into the studio, pretty much. I mean, is that pretty much true?
To an extent, I suppose they are. I mean, once we're in, though, we'll start to experiment a bit in terms of, you know, with this record, we recorded it in the south of England, and because of that, we were able to take all of our equipment down. So we basically set up in the control room and put everything with lots of different organs and lots of different amplifiers, and so it meant that we could sort of, if someone had an idea, you could go out and try it out. For us, a way that we can improve what we do is work on the arrangements and make them more interesting.
Mm-hmm. How about another song, guys? What are we going to hear next?
So we're going to hear The Past. So from the new record, Shadows.
One, two, three. Rolling through the city sprawl on a late night train. Survive us all. Waiting for a friend to call. I'm adrift again. I search for nothing at all. Modern life corrodes us all. Yourself a wake-up call. Let the past come back to rescue you. Seduced by a friendly fire, I just watched the room glow. Machines couldn't take me higher. Don't wanna be alone. Living tombstone, your warmth fills my desire. Modern life corrodes us all. You know that it's true. Give yourself a wake-up call. Let the past come back to rescue you.
that is Teenage Fan Club with The Past from their new album Shadows on Sound Opinions.
We want to thank Teenage Fan Club for being our guests on Sound Opinions. Norman, Raymond, Jerry, Dave, Francis, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Comment on our conversation with the members of Teenage Fan Club or anything else in the world of rock, call 888-859-1800 and we'll put it on the air. Next up, Greg and I review the new album by hip-hop provocateur Kanye West. And then it's my turn at the Desert Island Jukebox. That's all in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and that is a track from the new Kanye West album, My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy. It's a track called All of the Lights. Kanye West, one of the most in-demand producers in the business before he started making his own records. Jay-Z brought him to New York from Chicago to start making beats not only for Jay-Z, but for people like Talib Kweli, Mos Def, Benny Siegel, Foxy Brown, Ludacris. Kanye had plenty of success as a beat maker, but there was serious doubt about whether or not he was a rapper, a star in his own right. He proved everybody wrong in 2004 with The College Dropout, his debut album, and ever since then he's had a steady stream of hit records. As a rapper, songwriter, performer, producer, he is a quadruple threat, one of the few in the business and one of the most successful acts of the last 6-7 years. Of course, we can't talk about Kanye West without talking about controversy. I mean, just in the last few months, we're talking about an artist who, the former president of the United States, George Bush, said he was the low point of his presidency for something he said about the Hurricane Katrina disaster a few years ago on national television. A lot of people know Kanye West for one thing, that he bum-rushed the stage when Taylor Swift was receiving an award and said, you don't deserve this. Nonetheless, there is plenty of music to talk about, and Jim and I are going to review this record in a second, My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, but let's play a track from it first. Hell of a Life from Kanye West on Sound Opinions.
Just fell in love with a porn star. Turn the camera on, she a born star. Turn the coroners in a foreign car. Call the coroners through the CPI. She gave that old n***a osa. Bittersweet taste made his gold teeth faint. Make a knee shake, make a priest faint. Make a nun, make a cremate. Move downtown, cop a sweet space. Living life like we want a sweet space. What? We headed to hell for heaven's sakes, huh? Well, I'ma levitate, make the devil wait. Yeah, have you long?
crossed your mind? Tell me when you think we crossed the line. No more drugs for me. Your religion is all I need. Grab my hand and baby, we'll live a hell of a life.
That is Hell of a Life by Kanye West from studio album number 5, My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy. And Greg, it is nothing short of a beautiful masterpiece. Kanye West continues to astound me. And people at home may be skeptical right now. They're saying, what? This guy is just a jerk. Yeah, he may be a jerk. Let me remind you that John Lennon once said something that enraged the entire Northern Hemisphere about religion and the Beatles. Let's separate the musician from the music. I don't care what Kanye does with Taylor Swift and all that other stuff. What he is doing in terms of bringing in pretty much the entire palette of popular music into hip-hop is nothing short of extraordinary. Sampling 21st Century Schizoid Man by King Crimson, mm-hmm. nicking the melody of Iron Man by Black Sabbath, humming or singing a beautiful, and I mean breathtakingly beautiful, David Gilmour quality guitar solo with his vocals through a vocoder. You know, here you have a guy who is putting his heart right on the table. I didn't know if it would be possible more than the album that came before, 808s and Heartbreak, about the death of his mother and the end of his engagement. I didn't know if he could be more honest and bear more of his soul. Here he is. This is like a therapy session. Mm. And it's not for nothing I made that Lennon comparison. When Lennon sang about the loss of his mother and the horrible things that had happened to him as a child, you know, Kanye doesn't like himself very much. Nobody in hip-hop, heck, nobody in all of popular music ever does that and say, I can be pretty despicable. I can be a sexist. I can be a lousy boyfriend. I can be a raging egotist. But I believe in the power of music is the message that comes through again and again through these songs, none of which are conventional hip-hop. Some of these are 7, 8, 9 minute tracks. Mm-hmm. This is like a merger of Yes or Genesis or the most ornate Beatles with hip-hop. You have gathered by now on the Buy It, Burn It, Trash It scale. This is a truly extraordinary and enthusiastic buy it.
I would agree with a lot of what you said. I think he is on a scale with somebody like a Brian Wilson in the 60s or a Marvin Gaye or Stevie Wonder in the 70s in the terms of what he's shooting for here, the ambition of these records. The thing he has going against him is this almost pathological allegiance to saying exactly what's on his mind at every minute without any kind of filtering. But, you know, he's aware of that. And that gives his music not only a sense of bravado, but vulnerability. And he's playing both sides against each other on this record. The same thing with the music. He's got this incredible classical opulence going on. You know, he's got harpsichords on here, choirs,
cellos,
trumpet fanfares. And at the same time, there's this grimy element, too, mm-hmm. these dirty percussion sounds, the dirty guitars that you were mentioning. He's bringing all of these elements together. I mean, he's just hugely ambitious, multi-layered, a kind of record you could spend weeks dissecting just the music about it. Forget about what you think about this guy as a person. This guy owns his jerkdom, and I applaud that honesty, but I also even more applaud just the musical ambition and how he pulls it off on this record. My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, a buy-it record all the way.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
Remember, we were shipwrecked together.
As often as possible on Sound Opinions, we like to take a trip to the desert island and drop a quarter in the jukebox to play a song we cannot live without. And this week it is Jim DeRogatis' turn.
Thank you, Greg. I have had Beatles on the brain, and not only because of that iTunes news we covered earlier. I finally caught up with an absolutely stellar film last weekend, Nowhere Boy, which is the story of John Lennon at age 14, 15, as he first falls in love with rock and roll, forms a little skiffle group, okay, mm-hmm. that will go on eventually to become the Beatles, and the really weird upbringing.
You know, he's raised by his aunt, but his mother, who's a very troubled woman, lives, you know, just around the corner, and he doesn't know it until he's 15, and, you know, yada, yada, yada. It's a great movie. I think it makes a great double feature with Backbeat, which picks up the story in Hamburg. But I was thinking about this moment of how Lennon came to fall in love with rock and roll. And there's a wonderful scene in the movie, which has been in several of his biographies. He is down on the docks of Liverpool. He runs into an American sailor. He has just shoplifted, young punk that he is, a bunch of vinyl 45s from the local record store. It's all jazz. It's all jazz. I hate it. He's throwing them into the water. And this American sailor comes up and says, "Well, you know, wait a minute. Don't just ditch those. You know, I'll trade you." And gives him a 45 by an American artist, one Jalassie Hawkins, born in Cleveland, Ohio, soon to become known to the world as Screamin' Jay Hawkins. This is one of the classic tracks of early rock and roll. You know, you got Elvis, you got Little Richard, you got Chuck Berry, all due props to them. I think the first guy to really bring fear and loathing into rock and roll was Screamin' Jay Hawkins. Hmm. With that 56 single, huge smash, "I Put a Spell on You." Banned on radio stations across the country. He was accused of everything from voodoo incantations in this song to horrible depictions of assault, largely because he was stinking drunk when he recorded it and started mumbling and moaning and grunting and wheezing to the point where he never remembered the next day recording this song, and they played it for him and he had to learn it from what he had done in a drunken stupor, or so the story goes. I love the scene of the impact that this made on this young, impressionable boy half a world away in Liverpool, and how that would go on to form his life. Because of that, I just got to play Screamin' Jay Hawkins. It was good enough for John Lennon. It's good enough for me. I hope you too. I Put a Spell on You on Sound Opinions.
I put a spell on you. Cause you're mine. Stop the things you do. Watch out! I ain't lying. Ah, I can't stand. Woo! No running around. I can't stand. I can't stand no putting me down. Spell on you. Because you're mine.
The immortal Screamin' Jay Hawkins with I Put a Spell on You, my Desert Island Jukebox pick for the week. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, our annual turkey shoot, those records for which we had high expectations but let us down.
Greg, as always, we have some thank yous to say. Teenage Fan Club was recorded by Mary Gaffney. Our production team, in terms of Beatles songs. Intern Julia Mullen-Gordon. Well, she's Julia, no doubt. A Hard Day's Night, that would be Jason Saldana. Hey Bulldog, our other producer, Robin Lynn. And Tori Southside Malatia, our executive producer and fearless leader. He's kind of Maxwell's silver hammer.
I don't care!
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So now it's time to hear what you have to say.
messages.
Hey, this is Carrie Brief from Raleigh, North Carolina. I'm calling in regards to the recording industry suing that woman and countless others. When they started doing that, I stopped buying music. I continued to go to live shows, and I still do. And I'll buy a CD directly from a band, as I did last night. But I refuse to support an industry that sues its customers. I don't agree with illegal downloading, but there's a better way to handle it. They've lost my business. So until they change their ways, no way. They're not getting my money. Thanks.
I was just listening to your show on the Rock Doctor giving suggestions to cast in Chicago. I thought your selections were right on. But I also think you should probably suggest to her a group called Soul Live. They're very funky, good horn section. I think you should recommend their first album that I brought by them called Doing Something. It's very funky, it's soulful, and that definitely will get her customers jump in there. I just wanted to put that out there to you guys. This is Daryl calling from the Bronx. You guys did a great show. I love your show. Thanks. Bye.
Gentlemen, thank you for the sound bit on Brian Eno. I was introduced to Brian Eno by my French teacher my first year at college, and his wife was actually French, and she had all this vinyl of Eno. Music for Airports was in there, and it was my introduction to the concept of ambient music. I also had access to something that was called I'll Come Running to Tie Your Shoe, which was so incredibly sweet. I'll come running to tie your shoe.
I'll come running to tie your shoe. I'll come running to tie your shoe. I'll come running to tie your shoe.
I haven't had access to Brian Eno in so long. All that stuff is just past my fingertips these days. Thanks for giving me an update on what Brian Eno has done. My name's Rich. I'm in the Philadelphia market.
Hi, my name is Trish, and I just wondered if you had heard CeeLo Green do his F.U. song on Stephen Colbert, on the Colbert Report. It was really cute, and instead of F.U., he used Fox News.
So you drive around town with the girl I love on Fox News. See one politician wasn't corrupt.
Anyway, it was a lot of fun. Thanks a lot. Bye.
No more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.